Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Bonus Episode 4, The Supernatural Realm, with Dr. Michael Heisen. This is part 2 of our interview with Dr. Heiser. In the first episode, we of course focused on the ancient Israelite and Jewish background to Christology. In this episode, we shift gears and look at the Israelite and Judean background to early Christian views about the supernatural realm, angels, demons, evil spirits, the devil, etc. I think you'll certainly find this one as fascinating as the first half of our interview. So I hope you enjoy it very much. Kind of switching gears now. In an upcoming episode, we'll be talking about early Christian beliefs about the supernatural world, and this is an area that is what first really drew me to your work. And one of the, at least in the second and third century church fathers that I see pop up again and again, is the myth of the Watchers and how that informs their understanding of the kind of world they live in and why evil exists and why how they understand what paganism is. I was curious if you could talk about Genesis 6 and its background and kind of the history of the Watcher tradition in early Judaism.
Yeah, it was a pretty big deal. You know, I've said on a number of occasions that if you asked, you know, let's just start with modern, if you asked the average Christian today, why is the world so messed up, they would say the fall. If you ask that to a Second Temple Jew, they would not say the fall. They would include the fall along with two other episodes. One of them was the Genesis 6, 1 through 4, really 1 through 5 passage, that incident. And that, in Second Temple parlance, that's the story of the Watchers. And then also what happened at Babel. So there were really three sort of events that fomented and accelerated, solidified, again, whatever word we want to use here, human depravity. And then they naturally expected the Messiah to fix all three, not just to fix the death problem and the estrangement from God problem, but to fix the depravity issue and then regather the nations that were disinherited at Babel. You know, that's Deuteronomy 32, 8, and 9. So the middle one of these is the Watcher, you know, tradition. So that whole episode was a big deal in the Second Temple period because it was viewed as the, in some Jewish texts they give you the flavor that this is where human evil originated. Other ones would not go that far. Other ones would say, well, you know, we did have this thing called the fall happen and Adam, you know, sinned willingly. He didn't have his arm twisted here. So they would take human responsibility seriously, but then they would look at what happened in Genesis 6 with the sons of God and the daughters of men, you know, the Watchers and the daughters of men, and say that that was a means by which the, you know, the sinister intelligences of the dark powers, the spiritual world, they essentially, the real issue wasn't the Nephilim, you know, that had come out of that. The real issue is what they taught humankind in the Watchers' traditions. And there are things like arts of seduction, warfare, and, you know, bloodshed, astrology, idolatry. Basically, what at the feet of the Watchers, at the feet of these sinister divine beings, gets laid the proliferation of depravity among humanity. And they went that direction in interpretation because whoever wrote books like Enoch, especially, which is sort of the, you know, sort of the locus point for a lot of this, whoever wrote that book was very well acquainted with what turns out to be the original Mesopotamian context for Genesis 6, 1 through 5. And we know that they had a good knowledge of that Mesopotamian material because of things like the Book of the Giants at Qumran and the way they dip into Mesopotamian material in other texts. So the backstory for Genesis 6, 1 through 5 was a Mesopotamian story of the Apkallu, which before the flood were divine beings. After the flood, they're sort of a mix, divine and human. And, you know, they're giants after the flood, after this cohabitation sort of event. And they're the ones that teach, you know, human beings, again, bad things. They get consigned to the abyss, hell, you know, by Marduk in the Mesopotamian story. So whoever, you know, Genesis 6, 1 through 5 is taking a shot at that story, because if you're a Babylonian, this was a good thing. This is why Babylon is so great, so magnificent, because we had these divine beings. When some of the gods wanted to destroy us, you had these guys that wanted to give us knowledge and preserve human civilization. So they're wonderful. They're culture heroes. They're good guys. Whereas the biblical writers, like, nah, not so much. You know, they injected depravity into the world. They spawned the giants, who, by the way, were bent on our destruction. That's probably not a good thing. You know, and Babylon becomes this chaos metaphor through a lot of the Old Testament for all of the forces that work against God's will, God's plan, and God's people. And this is just another one of them, you know, tracing this back to Babylon. So there's all sorts of threads that extend from the Genesis 6 episode that the Second Temple writers were aware of. And the material that they used, you know, becomes not only part of their work, but it gets cited by Peter and Jude. There are other places where the Watcher story bleeds into the New Testament. So New Testament writers were aware of this material and occasionally found it useful for articulating some point, you know, of doctrine or, you know, something, some comment they're making. But in the Jewish world, this was a big deal. This was the big explanation for depravity, its proliferation. And again, some of them went so far as to sort of say this is when evil, you know, human sin really began, or something to that effect. That humanity was corrupted by rival supernatural intelligences that wanted humanity to be destroyed. So it became a big part of their theology.
I think that's really interesting how the original context for Genesis 6 is an attack on, you know, the paganism of Mesopotamia, that the utilization of the Watcher story to invert and you know, demonize the religion of the pagans in that area.
It's a good word for it that you just use, this inversion. You see that happen a lot.
Yeah, and because that's precisely how Justin Martyr and Athenagoras of Athens, and even Clement of Alexandria, somewhat use the Watcher myth. They're not interacting with the Mesopotamian deities, but like Justin says flat out, that the demonic children of the giants are the gods of Greece and Rome, which is just it's just fascinating to see that same train of thought, between in both eras.
It's interesting because that, you know, Justin's tracking on an important idea, but he actually conflates the Babel episode, which itself goes back to obviously Babylon. He conflates the Babel episode with Genesis 6, which also happened in Jewish texts as well, you know, for different reasons, but. It's very clear that he sees something there, and he's tracking on an important point. And, you know, in his you know, literary goings back and forth, you know, with the Jewish community there, I guess that's not a surprise.
Do you think authors like Justin had access to some of that Enochic material, maybe in a Greek form, or that they got it from other Christians, or
I would bet they had it in Greek form. I mean, the Greek material is Second Temple material, so it's older than the New Testament era. I don't see any reason, nor have I ever come across any claim that somehow that was lost to the early church fathers. I would bet that's the case, because this would be a good question. If you know the answer to this, or a study on it, I'd really appreciate hearing it. It seems to me that I could probably count on one hand the early church thinkers that knew Hebrew. And so my gut would tell me that their exposure to this stuff is in Greek, you know, translations of that material.
Yeah, that makes sense. This is one of those areas that I'm hoping patristic scholars will look into more. It just seems like
there's a dissertation in there.
Yes, the importance of the Watcher myth for patristic thought, at least in the second and third centuries, is it's much more prominent, I think, than is often realized.
Have you read? There's Annette Yoshiko Reed. She has she wrote a book on the reception of Genesis 6 in Judaism and early Christianity. But online, she actually has an article on Justin Martyr and the Watchers tradition. I'm curious if you've come across that.
I have come across her book. I've read also, I think she also wrote a chapter on Justin in another book called About the Watchers in Judaism and Early Christianity. I can probably
maybe
get
it
that.
Might be the same thing.
Yeah, I can probably get that.
Right, yeah, here. Somebody might have pulled it online, or maybe she put an early version of it out there. But there is some stuff like that. Schultz has a really interesting article. Let me see if I can pull up the reference to that for your audience here. Where would I? Okay, I know where I would find that. Let's see here.
You said Chestnut?
No, Schultz. I'll find it here in a second. I just have to open the bibliography here. But it's actually very interesting. Yeah, it's called, the article I'm thinking of is D.R. Schultz, The Origin of Sin in Irenaeus and Jewish Pseudepigraphical Literature. It's from the Vigile Christiane Journal, volume 32. It's 1978. But that's a really interesting article. To see what Irenaeus does with it.
Yeah, because that... I know he references it in Against Heresies, but also in Apostolic Preaching, he puts that event, you know, and with the full, you know, Enochic edition of the story with, you know, the Watchers or the fallen angels giving mankind this forbidden knowledge.
Yeah.
I was thinking of the Watchers in Jewish and Christian tradition. There's a chapter in there by a guy named Randall Chestnut. About Justin, but I have seen Reed's book. Just haven't gotten to it yet. But
now I'm looking for Chestnut. You're feeding my obsession here. Do I have that article? Oh, I do not. So give me the title again.
It's The Watchers in Jewish and Christian Traditions. The editors are Angela Kim Harkins, Kelly Buck.
Yeah, I have that in hard copy. I was looking at PDFs, but I do have that book, so I'll go look that up. That's good. Sweet.
Yeah. So hopefully at some point there'll be a major monograph dedicated to full study of this through your I'm one of the subscribers of Newsfeed, and I was able to read that article by Vanderkam on Enoch in early Christian literature, a little bit broader, but
the apocalyptic tradition.
So kind of that, of course, you know, now that we're talking about fallen angels, you know, one of the things that people today, if they think of fallen angels and the origin of that, they think of the devil leading a rebellion prior to the creation of man. But at least from what I've seen in Second Temple Judaism and in the early centuries of the church, the fall of the devil and the fall of angels were kind of not linked quite so much in that way, and the fall of angels is identified as the descent of the Watchers, correct?
Yeah. I think the idea you described comes along later.
Yeah. kind of jumping from there, obviously, talking about fallen angels and demons, the figure of the devil, of course, always comes up. And, one of the contrasts I think a lot of people are sometimes struck by between the Old and New Testaments is that in the Old Testament, at least on the surface, there doesn't appear to be this cosmic antagonist in the way that you have in the New Testament. And in the New Testament, it sort of assumes that, that at least from, as far as I can think, none of the New Testament authors ever stopped to explain, oh, by the way, we have this belief in this figure of the devil. It's kind of assumed that the reader knows it. How did that figure come about in Second Temple Jewish thought?
Yeah, you certainly don't have. This is a variegated issue and problem. So the short, the Cliff Notes version here is in Job 1 and 2, by rule of Hebrew grammar, the Satan, the Satan figure in Job 1 and 2, is not the devil. It's not a proper personal name. It's not a figure called the devil or capital S Satan. And that's because Satan is prefixed with a definite article. Hebrew does not prefix definite articles before proper personal names, just like English does not. I'm not the Mike. Okay. Right. So you have that going on. And in Job 1 and 2, Zechariah 3, all the instances of Satan have the definite article. So we're not talking about the devil there. But that doesn't stop people. And it didn't stop people, in the Second Temple period, from sort of making assumptions about that figure. And the connections would usually be conceptual, that here you have a figure in the heavenly council challenging, taking some sort of adversarial or oppositional posture to something God is saying about Job in Job 1 and 2, or in Zechariah 3, you have Joshua the high priest, and he's getting accused of sins. And so you have this notion of, well, a bad guy would do that sort of stuff. And so you begin to have this sort of notion that, on one hand, you could say, well, they're sort of looking back and sort of inserting a super arch enemy figure into these Old Testament passages. And then the Christians are guilty of the same hermeneutical crime and all that kind of stuff. Well, I mean, I get that, but I don't think that's necessarily a coherent trajectory. I mean, you certainly have in the Old Testament an original divine rebel. Okay, you got that guy. You got that figure in Genesis 3, the serpent, the Nakash. And you've got other divine rebellions in Genesis 6, and then you've got the sons of God allotted to the nations at Babel. They turn into bad guys or corrupt. They become corrupt in Psalm 82 and all that stuff. So you've got enough divine rebellion to go around here. But it's kickstarted by this one particular individual. And so the concept of this original supernatural enemy is certainly there. He gets cast down into the underworld, the realm of the dead, whether that's Sheol or Eretz. Eretz is the normal word for earth, but it's also a term for the underworld. So you got this original rebel cast down. He no longer works for God. Don't show up Monday, you're not going to be on the payroll anymore. He's jettisoned out, cast down to this place. Adam and Eve are expelled from the garden, which means they are detached, estranged from the source of life, which is the presence of God himself, and they are now going to die. And so, you have this association with death. You have a lot of these things sort of accumulate in the realm of the dead with this figure in Genesis 3. That people take that in the Second Temple period in Judaism, and they sort of glom on some other things to that figure. And eventually what they produce is going to look a lot like the New Testament idea of Satan. In the Second Temple period, what they do is they interpret the text. they interpret the Hebrew Bible. And there are a lot of people who think, oh, this is radical. You know, they're adding to theology here. Oh, this is just, you know, crazy. And boy, you know, they shouldn't do that. And well, look, I got news for you. Next time you're reading your New Testament and they quote the Old Testament, guess what? You're going to find that they interpret the Hebrew Bible. They do that. They make theological extrapolations from passages, and that becomes part of the New Testament text. This is really no different. It operates in the Second Temple period. It operates in the New Testament. All of the data points for the idea of capital S Satan in the New Testament, the data points are available somewhere. The trajectory point is available somewhere in the Old Testament, but the Old Testament never makes these connections. And so on the one hand, New Testament demonology or Satanology looks quite different, but if you actually take it apart, you can find passages and conceptual themes in the Old Testament that provide a basis for the perspective that's being offered in this later literature. So it's not quite as radical as, you know, certain scholars would suggest. For sure, you don't have a developed, you don't have a developed doctrine of Satan in the Old Testament. You don't have a Satan, capital S, figure like you do in the New Testament, present in the Old. But what you do have is you have the profile. You have the pieces of the profile, and they get woven together by writers in the Second Temple period, and they are largely adopted by New Testament writers who, guess what? They are products, by and large, of Judaism in the Second Temple period. So I think you're correct in the way you articulated the question, that the New Testament writers, they don't really unpack this. They make certain statements about Satan as though everybody just sort of knows that. And my view would be is, yeah, that's because they basically did, because of this other literature. Again, writers who had, you know, done interpretive work, taken the pieces of the Old Testament and wove them together and produced, again, a particular portrait of this arch enemy, this original rebel, that by that time you do in Greek have Satan, Satanas, used as a proper personal name. So it's, you know, Hebrew, it's the adversary, the challenger. You've got Diabolos, the liar, you know, that kind of thing, the slanderer, you know, adversarial figure. They're looking at it and it's like, well, that's a good term to call this guy. That's kind of what he does. That's kind of what he did. So let's just take that term and make it a title now, make it a proper personal name. And that's what they do. And the New Testament inherits that whole thing.
One of the Old Testament passages I've heard you discuss on this topic is Ezekiel's taunt against the king of Tyre in Ezekiel 28. Mm-hmm. And I think the view of a lot of scholars today is kind of similar to the rabbinic view, that the figure, the king of Tyre, is being compared to as Adam. Mm-hmm. But you take kind of a more minority position, which is similar to the patristic interpretation, that the figure is this original divine rebel.
Yeah, the consensus view that the cherub is Adam, or that, you know, you basically don't have a divine rebel in Ezekiel 28. You know, you've got these references to God expelling Adam, you know, instead of a divine being. That's largely based on taking the Septuagint as the text of the passage, because if you do that, that's the way that the Septuagint translator handled some difficulties in the Masoretic text. And the way he chose to handle certain things made that the reading of that particular passage. You know, I'm of the view that you don't need to change the Masoretic text here. It has unusual features, but there are features that you encounter elsewhere that don't require a revision. So if you stick with the Masoretic text, you come out with, you don't have Adam being the referent. You have, something else. You have a supernatural figure. And I just think that the supernatural rebellion theme fits a whole lot better. It kind of amazes me that I think there's some obvious disconnects with the consensus view. I don't know why we would, why we would say certain things about Adam that are said in Ezekiel 28. On what basis can we say that he wanted to be like the Most High? When that language comes right out of divine rebellion stories from Ugarit, it's word for word. Where you have one particular, divine being wanting to be above the stars of El, the stars of God, which is just, again, word for word explicit language out of Canaanite supernatural rebellion text. Even the meeting place, the Har Moed, the Mount of Assembly, it's right out of the same, Canaanite Ugaritic text. It seems very clear to me what the Old Testament writer is using to paint the king of Tyre as. He's comparing his arrogance to the arrogance of one of these lesser beings to be in charge of the divine council. And that's certainly an act of hubris. Well, I don't see Adam ever doing anything like that. I don't see Adam ever trying to overtake God's position of rule in the divine abode, which was Eden, the place of the divine council and all that stuff. I see Adam as kind of like, takes the apple from Eve or whatever the fruit was. And yeah, okay, you didn't drop over dead, so let's try that. It seems like he's a lot less devious, a lot less calculated than the description we get in Ezekiel 28. So I just have a number of issues with that sort of thing. That the gemstones and all that, scholars want to say those are the gemstones of the high priest. Well, it's just kind of too bad that they don't match. They're incomplete. I think it's a reference to the council, the cosmic, getting into unseen realm terminology here, but the cosmic mountain, because the gemstones do match the description of the new Eden, which is, again, the global Eden, at the end in the book of Revelation. I think that's the point. I don't think it's about the high priest. So there are a number of conceptual disconnects there, but it's fair to say that my view is a minority view on that. So my view is based on the embracing a very clear supernatural rebellion antecedents to Ezekiel 28 that Ezekiel 28 very clearly dips into. It's also based on an acceptance of the Masoretic text as it stands, instead of deferring to the Septuagint. So I think those two things in hand, and the third reason would be, again, some of these points of disconnect, like with the high priest and all that. I think it just makes more sense to see a supernatural rebellion theme that's lurking in the backdrop of what Ezekiel says about the king of Tyre in that passage.
Would the Canaanite material that Ezekiel's drawing on, would this be kind of similar to the Astar material in the Baal cycle that Isaiah 14 draws on? I've read your article talking about that.
Yeah, I think that's part of the same, again, matrix of ideas where you have, I take the Astar story not as a comment on Astar's deficiencies, but that Astar snubs the decree of the Most High, to occupy the throne there. So I think it's part of the same complex or matrix of ideas. It's kind of interesting. You have this cherubim terminology in Ezekiel 28. A lot of people don't point out things like that, in Mesopotamia, it's a Mesopotamian term, Karibu, and they have snake, dragon, cherubim in Mesopotamia, who were throne guardians. There just seem to be these obvious sort of connection points that never really get looked at because people have sort of just out of the gate decided, well, we're going to go with the Septuagint text because that gets rid of all the grammatical oddities of the Masoretic text. And if we take the Septuagint, well, then we've got a cherub with you know, with the king, and Adam would be the king, and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, they don't really there are too many important elements of the discussion that get bypassed to me if you just sort of out of the gate opt for that reading.
Kind of circling back to what we were talking about earlier with the Divine Council, and you had brought up the you know, the Cosmic Mountain as I've read your work where you discuss this as the meeting place. Now the Divine Council, that is associated with the events of the Tower of Babel, correct?
Yeah, that's one passage.
Yeah, the nations are divided up into 70, depending on how you count them, and each has a one of the sons of God put over them.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've read Origen and Eusebius, talk about, Deuteronomy 32 and the boundaries of the nations, and the nations having these angelic princes, and there seems to be some, and you've already sort of referenced this, there, some sort of ambiguity about at least in Second Temple Jewish thought, were those beings good beings, or were they evil? Were they fallen at some point? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, they tend to be, viewed after the fact, and what I mean by that is, they tend to be viewed as the, since they become in the scriptural record, since they are referred to negatively in Psalm 82 and Deuteronomy 32 as these gods that Israel winds up sacrificing to, you know, these gods that were not allotted to Israel but were allotted to the nations. They tend to be viewed in Second Temple literature out of the gate as bad dudes. So Second Temple writers don't really get into the question of, well, were they evil on the day that they were appointed over the nations, or did they just become evil later? You know, that it's not even a question they ask. And so you don't really get a whole lot of help, you know, in that respect. I think my own personal view of this is that I think there's a consistent pattern where when you have members of the heavenly host rebel against Yahweh, they are not later employed, so to speak. God is still sovereign, you know, but it's a different thing to be sovereign over another entity and being able to engineer circumstances so that you might get a certain behavior out of an entity, or a human for that matter, that you want. I mean, you're big enough to do that. That's different than sort of having that entity in your employ, that this is somebody that you would task with specific things as though they were still in your service. So I think the instances where we get some more material, kind of a feel for what God's response to rebellion is, that you get passages where rebels are sort of punished, they're kept at a distance, that sort of thing. You know, the watchers are consigned to the abyss. You know, the original rebel in Genesis 3 is, you know, cast down to the abyss, the underworld, and all that stuff. Well, why would God then go and hire entities, you know, sons of God, Elohim, that were just as adversarial or just as hostile to his will as the first couple, you know, the first rebellious situations? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me that God would do that. I think where the idea comes from that these could be evil right out of the gate is, I think, a misunderstanding of passages in the Old Testament about how God sends an evil spirit, like to trouble Saul, or to, you know, harass, you know, some, you know, somebody in the period of the Judges. You know, you have this one of these passages. You know, evil there is just ra'ah in Hebrew. It can refer to calamitous, harmful, injurious, undesirable. It doesn't have to deal with moral evil. So I think in the passages in Saul, it can be quite coherent to just read that as God judging Saul with some either psychological or physical malady, or again, you know, some kind of judgment of Saul's wickedness. I mean, God there are references in the Psalms that you know, angels were, you know, God's agents, you know, in Egypt with the plagues. Well, that doesn't mean that those are evil guys. It doesn't mean that they're in rebellion to Yahweh, but hey, you're the best guys for the job, so I don't really care if you hate me, you know, I'm going to send you down there to do that. That just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It's inconsistent with the first two supernatural rebellion episodes. And so my view is that they were not evil when they were appointed, but they become corrupt. But in the Second Temple period, they're sort of viewed after the fact because of their history. You know, what happens to Israel in light of this when Israel gets seduced, you know, to worship other gods.
You mentioned earlier how the Babel event and the Watcher tradition is conflated in Justin Martyr, and I think Eusebius sort of conflates them as well. In the Second Temple period, did the Jews link the beings of Genesis 6 and their children at all with the princes put over the nations?
Yeah, there are a couple of writers that do that, that will use the kind of language that conflates the categories. You also have the issue of the Septuagint using daimonion for all of the groups, which again tends to conflate the characters in that sense. And so, you know, the New Testament is going to be inheriting that. Certainly the early church in Greek is going to be inheriting that idea. So it loses a bit of precision in that regard. But I think, you know, it leaks. It's kind of curious with Paul, because on one hand, you know, Paul uses the daimonion language in 1 Corinthians 10, 21 and 22, when he's quoting Deuteronomy 32, 17 about the Shadim, which are territorial entities. Unfortunately, that in English translations, Shadim gets translated as demons in Deuteronomy 32, 17. But it's very clear that they're not, those aren't the guys that we're talking about in the Gospels. And they're very clear, it's very clear because of it comes from Shadu Akkadian, which again was a divine entity that had some attachment to a specific territory. It's much more consistent with the Deuteronomy 32 stuff. But nevertheless, Paul uses daimonion, you know, of that passage. Why does he do that? Well, there's two possible reasons. One, he's quoting the Septuagint. That's what that's got. So how much can we really draw about, you know, is Paul like contradicting the language he uses elsewhere when he uses the language of geographical authority for the dark powers, you know, principalities, powers, thrones, dominions, rulers, you know, they're all geographical dominion terms. I don't think Paul's contradicting himself. I think it's, even if he wasn't using the Septuagint, daimonion is an elastic enough term. Mm-hmm. Again, it's just a supernatural being that, they're, you know, Paul's allowed to use that because it's not going to confuse people. They're going to know the story. They're going to know who, you know, they're going to know that it can be, you know, good or bad, and Paul's connecting it with idolatry. Okay, this is bad. These are bad guys. You know, it's not Jesus and the God of Israel, so let's back off there, Corinthian church. I mean, they're going to still get the message. So I don't think Paul's language there is creating some sort of conundrum as far as his own consistency.
In the case of Paul or the New Testament writers in general, you know, one of the phrases that pops up is the devil and his angels.
Yeah.
The devil's angels. Do you think that is that a reference to?
It's right out of the Second Temple stuff.
Okay.
You'll have the same kind of thing where you have Satan used in a capital S situation in at least one text. Also, mastema, which, again, without getting into the linguistic reasons, the STM of mastema is related philologically to the STN of Satan. So mastema is a Satan figure, not just for linguistic reasons, but that's the way he's portrayed. Belial, Beliar, mastema, these are all terms applied to the same individual. And so in Second Temple texts, you get the other rebels aligned with him, and for some reason, we're not specifically told, it's not spelled out to us, in other words, for some reason King, you know, the Satan figure, is sort of given this primacy of place in terms of the pecking order. You have to speculate as to why that would be. There's a number of reasons it could be. There was an association of the abyss with the desert wilderness. You even get that in the Old Testament as well. But that's outside Israel. So now we're in Deuteronomy 32 territory. The nations around Israel are under the dominion of other gods. Well, if the desert wilderness out there is the domicile of Satan, and in Enoch text it's also the domicile of the Watchers, that's the doorway into which, you know, they were sent and imprisoned. Well, that conceptually ties all three rebellions together. You know, the original rebel, then the two other groups of rebels. And so Second Temple writers were noticing things like that. And so to them it felt very natural to sort of view them as peas in the same pod. But for some reason, the original rebel gets elevated to the leader. I personally think it has something to do with death, the realm of the dead, that he is, the original rebel sort of gets ownership, if we can use that term, dominion, control over humanity. And of course, humans occupy those other nations, don't they? Mm-hmm. And humans are, of course, were made more depraved by the rebellion of the Watchers. But none of those things would really cohere well if we didn't have the original rebel put them under the curse in the first place. And so he sort of gets street cred, if I can say it that way, for that reason. I just personally believe it has something to do with death and the realm of the dead and this hostility toward humanity. That's sort of a tie that binds in the mind of the Second Temple writer. And then the New Testament writers, you know, will embrace those sort of interpretive trajectories in what they're writing as well.
So would it be accurate to say that when New Testament authors use the phrase the devil and his angels, the devil's angels is kind of a mix of entities, or it's beings from both of the of those later rebellions, Genesis 6 and the princes of the nations kind of thing?
Yeah, it's really, you get this, I mean, you know, just think about it a little bit, and you could, you know, again, try to trace the conceptual roots to why this would, not just to a New Testament writer, but to a Second Temple writer, because the Second Temple period, they conflate all these groups under the leadership of Satan. You know, Satan is described, you know, as their leader. You know, you've got, again, you get the realm of the dead working, you know, going on, the devil and his angels. So you've got the main figure there. And again, because of what's going on as far as their, how do I want to say it? They're all going to wind up in the same place. And in the Old Testament, they're all associated with that same place. They're just not there permanently. You know, the original rebel, this is his kingdom now. This is his rule. He rules the realm of the dead. He has ownership of the human soul. He's Lord of the dead. So he's already there. And then in the Old Testament, you find, oh, the Rephaim are down there too. You know, so that's a link back to Genesis 6 with the giant clans and the Second Temple idea that demons are the disembodied spirits of the dead giant clans, the dead Nephilim. Well, they're there too. And then you've got, again, this desert wilderness association. So with the surrounding nations. And you know, conceptually, if you're not aligned with the God of Israel, why would you ever think that you're going to escape Sheol with a faithful Israelite? You're not faithful to the right God, to the Most High. You're out there worshiping other gods, and so you're doomed. You're never going to escape the punishment, the curse of death. So, again, this is the tie that sort of binds. So devil and his angels, I think, you know, by the Second Temple period, they looked at these thought trajectories, and it just made sense to them to have everybody on the same team. And, you know, the whole lake of fire, well, yeah, that's kind of where it's going to be. Because what God is going to do in the end is he's going to take this place of death that all of these rebels wanted humanity to suffer in. In other words, they wanted humanity to die. They don't want humanity to experience eternal life with God. God is going to take that place that they hoped humans would wind up in forever and make it their place of torment. So we have an inversion idea again. So all the data points you can scour out of the Old Testament. The Old Testament doesn't put them together, but they are sort of coherent or reasonable trajectories to follow. And these writers did. I mean, they followed them. They sort of did the math in this way, and they went beyond the Old Testament in that respect. But New Testament writers do that in other respects too when they interpret the Old Testament. Sometimes you look back at how a New Testament writer cites an Old Testament passage and you got to wonder, where did you get that? what are you thinking there? But hey, it's in the New Testament. It has sort of that divine, imprimatur, that's the theological point that God, prompted this person to make, this New Testament writer, so deal with it. That's the way it is. And again, the fact that they're doing this, I think, gets a little too much attention when it comes to Satanology and demonology, like, oh, this is just unheard of. No, actually, it's not. It happens in a number of respects with messianic interpretation or some other point of interpretation of Israel's history or the exile or something like that. They're doing this kind of exercise in other areas, but this one just seems to get more attention.
One thing you particularly mentioned, and I know we gotta wrap up soon, but one of the last episodes we did before the narrative ended was on Antony of Egypt, and one of the interesting things that I notice is that when he encounters demons frequently in the desert. And they almost seem to act as if they at some point say to him, like, this is our territory. Like, they're almost,
lost.
Right. And and of course, he just
it's
goes in there.
It's a whole invasion,
I wonder if, and this is, of course, thinking ahead in the narrative, one of the perhaps not so wonderful things in, that you have Christians doing in the later part of the 4th century and early 5th is, especially monks, where they'll go out and in the countryside and in the desert and they'll attack idols. Because they sort of saw that as fighting the demons that were behind them. And this sort of, not that I'm saying that's a good thing, obviously, but it this idea of the desert and divine territoriality does kind of make me think of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think again, when they're doing stuff like that, you can sort of see that they're following certain threads. They are picking up on certain things. Have you read God's Rivals by Gerald McDermott?
I've heard of it. I read parts of it, but not all of it.
Yeah, I mean, because it's one of the few books that I think, with respect to the Deuteronomy 32 worldview thing, to me, it was really fascinating to see how the early church thinkers, the different takes they had on it, like whether this was sort of like pre-planned by God, to bring, people about to faith, or if this was just something that, we don't want to associate God with that, So just a different kind of the spectrum of opinion and the discussion that went on. So it's not just, the Antony text, but You can see that they're detecting threads, in the biblical material, and they're grappling with them. They're trying to discern, what these things mean. They're trying to draw theology from them, which I love to run into stuff like that, because honestly, that's what we're supposed to do. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, I absolutely. This has been awesome. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time, Dr. Heiser. Where can people find you?
Well, they can find me online at drmsh. So dr as in doctor, msh are my initials, drmsh.com. It's kind of the nerve center. I do biblical stuff there. I do sort of my own version of cultural criticism when it comes to crazy stuff that people believe about the ancient world and ancient religions, you know, and sort of science fiction, paranormal kinds of stuff. Stuff that's inherently religious in pop culture, even, you know, as bizarre as some of that can be. I have the Naked Bible podcast. NakedBiblePodcast.com is where we fixate a lot of our biblical stuff on. So I'm in lots of places. You know, I have a weird sort of apologetic ministry to people out there in the fringe community that I hope to convince to either not abuse the Bible so much or at least give it a chance, you know, rather than kind of accepting some sort of conspiratorial, you know, view of it.
Yeah, I've gotten some strange comments from some people even on my Facebook page. Or there's, I got this one that I don't know what planet this person came from, but
Nibiru.
Oh boy, yeah. Thankfully, it wasn't that, but
okay,
it was in that realm, we'll say.
Well, be warmed and filled.
yes. Thank you very much, and we'll go ahead and end this right here.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.